I want to start by introducing myself as well. My name is Krista Williams. I'm the Advocacy and Outreach Coordinator at the Native Youth Sexual Health Network, and we are a buy-in for Indigenous youth organization. We work across the United States and Canada, obviously, because we were there before the borders were there, and we certainly don't cross the borders. The borders crossed us. Very important distinction. I'm Delaware from Raven and Thames First Nation near London, Ontario, in southwestern. Kind of keep driving on the 401. And he'll pass us. It's a really very small square mile of a reserve, but I grew up in Mississauga in Port Credit on Mississauga's New Credit territory, and I currently live in Toronto, but our staff are based everywhere. We have staff in Oneida, Wisconsin, in Edmonton, Alberta, and then across Canada, all of our youth project coordinators. Our staff, board, everybody that works with us are under the self-identified Indigenous youth under the age of 30. Our youngest board member is about 15, so definitely never too old or too young to start doing advocacy, to start getting involved, to start, not even to start, to continue. I also, of course, want to acknowledge whose territory we're on. We're on Haudenosaunee, Six Nations of the Grand River Territory right now. But I think it's not enough to just acknowledge and just say, oh, by the way, this isn't Guelph. This is Haudenosaunee territory, but also understand what our relationship is to that land, to those people who, FYI, are still alive and kicking, which I think we sometimes forget. We're like, this is ancient land. No, this is somebody's home, and we also want to make sure that we understand your relationship to that. So whether you're Indigenous, whether you're a settler, and understanding what kind of relationship you have to the people on whose territory you are supposed to be a guest. And thinking about that, and also thinking about urban communities. I feel like 50% of our people now live in cities, and we kind of get the shaft sometimes when it comes to people wanting to talk to like radical Indigenous activists, and really wanting to make sure that we don't forget that Native people are everywhere. We're in cities, we're in rural towns, we're in northern, fly-in, and remote communities. We're sitting next to you on the bus. Whether you can see us or not, that's not our problem, that's yours. So also want to say thank you to the Guelph Native community on and off campus. A lot of the people that I went to school in Kitchener-Waterloo, and so thinking a lot about the Native people here in Guelph that taught me and supported me while I was going through my undergrad, and specifically Jan Sherman today, who led some of you in a medicine walk earlier this morning that I really wish I could have been here for. That would have been nice. And of course also acknowledging my own ancestors who fought pretty hard so that I could be here with you all today, and making sure that I always honor them. I really want to make sure that when you're hearing what I am sharing with you today, that we change the story a little bit, that when you hear some of the statistics or some of the realities, that this is not the tragic plight of the Indian. This is the reality of how to survive under colonialism. Right, under ongoing active colonialism, this is how we survive. So if anything that's shared today makes you uncomfortable or you're like shocked or whatever, maybe think about why that is, and think about why you don't know that this is the norm and this is the reality that we're facing. I'm gonna start by just getting some statistics out of the way, because we know that, we need to know what's going on, we need to know the current realities, but also, of course, stats never tell the whole story, since those numbers aren't actually a reflection of our full humanity or our full complexity in the realities of our lives. But just to give you an idea of where we're at right now. So 23% of people who are incarcerated in federal prison and 27% of people who are incarcerated in provincial jails self-identify as Aboriginal. So that's a big chunk of the population. We're about 3 to 4% of the general population. So you can see pretty big disparity there. And that's like a general stat for Canada. But you'll see those numbers fluctuate, particularly in areas where we're the majority, where Aboriginal people, Indigenous people make up, say, 50% of the population, such as in the prairies. Right, so in the prairies, if our general population count is more than 50%, then we also make up a greater proportion of the prison population. Between about 1996 and the 2006 census, our just general population of Aboriginal people grew by about 47% compared to 8%. So we're having more sex and more babies. Suckas. But just so you know that our population is growing at a faster rate than the general population. Also, half of our population is under the age of 25. So we're a much younger population. And these demographics play out in good ways and in bad ways, right? They're just population demographic stats. They don't, they're not going to dictate what happens, but it does mean that different social issues and the way that our communities are organized is going to be different. All right, so this also means that the more population increases, right, the more that we're going to see an increase inside as well. And since 2005 and 2006, there has been a 43% increase in Aboriginal inmate population. So those numbers are going up. And of course, we know in general, prison populations in Canada are currently at an all-time high. We're seeing historic numbers, overcrowding at crazy rates, just really the population and the amount of people being incarcerated keeps going up, while our general crime statistics are decreasing steadily and are oftentimes, for certain crimes, are at an all-time low. So it's something to think about while you're hearing what's going on. So there's been considerable attention to these statistics in terms of the news and, you know, flashy media stuff, we don't really consider them in the context of an ongoing colonial project, right? So people are always like, this is the Harper agenda, or this is the current way that things are. But what we're seeing is this is actually just the repetition of a pattern. This has actually been the trajectory that we've been on for a couple hundred years, and it's nothing new. So certainly if you're hearing these things for the first time and you're like, oh my gosh, that this is part of an ongoing project, it's not like new, it just happened yesterday. We're seeing prisons also as an extension of the residential school system. So we know that the last residential school closed in 96, awesome. So, well, that's not awesome. It's awesome that you knew that. So we obviously know that incarceration and putting people in places where they don't want to be is the new way, is not something new, right? This is the way that kind of the Indian problem has always been dealt with and represents an extension of that same system, right? So what we want to see is that all of these systems are interconnected. So we say, oh, residential schools are over. That was over. That was like, I was like 10 when the last residential school closed. It wasn't that long ago. And that while that particular brand or that particular face of colonialism might have gone away, there's a new kind of extension of that system, right? Nod with me so that I know I'm making sense. As a buy-in for Indigenous youth organizations, specifically at the Native Youth Sexual Health Network, we often see that conversations around prison health is such that we forget how early incarceration actually starts, particularly in the lives of Indigenous youth. We know that there's more Native youth in foster care now than ever were in residential schools, and child removal is still a very real threat to our communities and our ability to even just stay together as families and communities, because we still see that rate of state intervention, of child welfare taking away our children. So distinctions between prisons, whether they're federal or provincial, and juvenile and youth detention centers, group homes, and the conditions of Native youth on probation are often not talked about. So we want to kind of expand that conversation a little bit. And by the time Native youth find themselves in adult facilities, there may have already been a lifetime of interference from the state, whether that's interactions with the criminal injustice system. But when we consider the purpose of the police and things like the RCMP, this starts to make sense. And I literally pulled this from creation of the RCMP Wikipedia, which says, and I quote, as part of its national security and intelligence functions, the RCMP was responsible for infiltrating any ethnic or political groups that were considered to be dangerous to Canada's existing order. And of course, that existing order is colonialism, right? So the police are not there to serve and protect. Correctional Services of Canada is not there to help or support. Their original purpose and creation was specifically to incarcerate and prevent Indigenous people from asserting sovereignty. And by extension, obviously, that starts to include other people. I'm just talking about one part of the system that we're familiar with. Of course, we'll hear more from other panelists. And part of that process of colonialism, and it's such a big word, and I think it's ridiculous that we have to wait until university to figure out what these big words mean, even though we're interacting with them on a day-to-day basis, is to establish governance or authority by another jurisdiction, right? So you're establishing another type of authority over somebody else's, over their own authority by somebody else, right? By somebody who's outside, usually through the creation of settlements like Canada or by another country. So for people that are in poli-sci, you know what I'm talking about. But generally what I want to focus on is this idea of an imposition of authority other than your own. And of course, in doing so, that imposing power must also undermine the authority of Indigenous peoples, as well as our governance and political systems, such as our ability to raise families and children in our community, right? So child removal not just being like, oops, sorry, but actually a deliberate process by which children are removed so that we no longer have the authority and the sovereignty and the self-determination to raise our families. And of course, this couldn't be the overt agenda, right? If we actually all knew that was the purpose and that was going on and people actually listened to us, we need the benevolence of church workers, saviors, social workers to fill the role of enforcing that authority over us. And so I'm going to quote a little bit from Briar Patch Magazine, had a really great schools to prison pipeline article. I'm going to be quoting a bunch here because they said it much more better than I can, which is that the construction of European settlers as benevolent saviors of Native people and then Native people as ungrateful degenerates was necessary to justify the theft of Indigenous land and resources. This is all too often forgotten, as are the continued privileges settlers secure from casting Aboriginal people as dangerous and unruly. It is time to shift the focus from the colonized to the colonizers and to interrogate the interlocking systems that allow the over-incarceration of Indigenous people to continue. And I would just footnote to that and say not all Indigenous people identify as colonized, because a lot of our governance and authority systems and cultures and languages are still intact, but that's another workshop. There must also be some alternate explanations for why this authority is necessary, casting Indigenous peoples as unruly, as was mentioned, without governance of our own and in needing of organization and control. And so our diverse and really distinct cultures, right, like there is no pan-Indian culture, just so you know, must also be painted as the root of the problem as well as the solutions. So what we see is that this theory of cultural difference, right? So everybody's so different, your cultures are so different. And it gets repeatedly recycled and usually goes something like this. Aboriginal students are culturally different. The disconnect between their home lives and school lives is just so great, they're unable to succeed in school. More cultural awareness is needed on the part of educators, and more Aboriginal culture must be included in the curriculum. However, an emphasis on cultural differences also allows for the erasure of topics such as racism, discrimination, and violence. And perhaps most importantly, it allows the blame to remain with the Aboriginal other whose cultural differences have come to signify inferiority. And I'm pretty sure if the first settlers had a better sense of, say, East Coast Mi'kmaq Maliseet Indigenous cosmology, that wouldn't have stopped them from violating agreements, starting wars, and stealing land, right? Right? If we just like understood each other better, that would just prevent people from being assholes. I don't think so. Additionally, there have been laws in place that are meant to try and reduce the harm of this history, which is also ongoing, but certainly when we're looking at criminal law, it's really just talking about that we have to consider Aboriginal history. And so what we saw was Gladue decision, and again, this is something for you to Google later, which is a very, not terribly old decision, but about 1995, Supreme Court of Canada decided that particularly sentencing judges needed to consider the kind of the social histories of Aboriginal people, ongoing violence, racism, etc., when sentencing people. And there was a recent report called Spirit Matters from the Correctional Investigator of Canada that specifically looked at what's going on with the implementation of Gladue, among other things that were included in the report, but that's the part that I want to focus on. And so this compelled judges to make a different method of analysis in determining a suitable sentence for Aboriginal offenders by paying a particular attention to the unique circumstances of Aboriginal people and their social histories, which are commonly referred to as Gladue principles or factors. And so allegedly, Correctional Services Canada has incorporated Gladue principles into its policy framework, requiring it to consider Aboriginal social history when making decisions affecting the retained rights and liberties of Aboriginal offenders. Although the Gladue refers to sentencing considerations, the safety minister, the correctional investigator, was also saying that it's reasonable to conclude that this also, GLAAD also can't just be about sentencing. It has to be also about that it's actually applied at an operational level. It's actually applied at a policy level and not just when it comes to sentencing. And making sure that the Supreme Court, the original decision was they had the view of providing a culturally appropriate options for federally sentenced Aboriginal people, yet it was found, obviously, that GLAAD principles are not well understood within Correctional Services Canada and were unevenly applied, right? So basically not doing what the Supreme Court said they needed to do. However, since the exception acceptance of Bill C-10, the Omnibus Crime Bill, I'm really questioning how judges can simultaneously uphold GLAAD principles while also abiding by things like mandatory minimum sentencing. So we'll see how that goes. The report also still calls on judges to do so, to still uphold GLAAD principles, but also expand that application into how correctional services policies are implemented. And so we'll be seeing kind of how, and we've asked, you know, kind of legal folks, like, what is this decision? What does the omnibus bill C-10 and mandatory minimums and, you know, all of the things that are wrapped up in an omnibus bill that are hidden, how is this going to impact Aboriginal people? And other than things are going to suck more, that's the only, we haven't gotten a lot of specific answers as to what that's going to look like, specifically as it relates to GLAAD, because it seems like a very hypocritical law agenda, right? To say like, oh, you have to consider Aboriginal history and not sentences harshly, but now you have to have mandatory minimum sentencing that's going to affect Native youth disproportionately. So as the saga continues. So what the heck does this have to do with health and well-being of Indigenous youth and prisons? And what I really want to emphasize is that the over-incarceration of Indigenous people is not an unassailable reality. It's a violent colonial project that requires cooperation and complicity of countless people, of you all. And unmaking that situation is going to require the same sustained and concerted effort as went into creating it. So this is not going to go away in like 5 years. You know, we saw the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, whose mandate was to help and support the intergenerational effects of the residential school system. They were given a 5-year mandate. Residential schools operated for over 100 years. So really, we need to make sure that we're putting in the same effort to resist and dismantle these systems as there was put into it. And learning also how we're all invited to participate in this colonial project of Aboriginal over-incarceration and then refusing to do so is the first step in demolishing that pipeline from prison, pipeline to prison for Aboriginal youth specifically. And of course, recently I saw an article as I was preparing for today specifically looking at Native youth in the city of Toronto and the school boards, and that they're facing disproportionate suspensions, right? So we know that there's racism when it comes to sentencing, so that specifically Aboriginal youth and Aboriginal women are getting sentenced to harsher and longer sentences for similar offenses. And we are also seeing this in the school system. So we're also seeing that we're deemed unruly, dangerous behavioral issues at a very young age, such that we're sentenced, if you will, to suspensions in the school system as well. And knowing that that school system doesn't support our identities, doesn't support our realities, and is not, you know, it's been very resistant to change. It's also pretty ironic that with the recent changes to criminal law regarding HIV non-disclosure, which people may or may not be familiar with, where we're seeing more and more people living with HIV now being sentenced to extremely harsh sentences, regardless of the risk of actual transmission. Correctional Services is now being brought to court over the lack of basic HIV and Hep C prevention tools like safe injection equipment. When I heard about this, I always joked that I thought Correctional Services should be charged with HIV non-disclosure because you're pretty likely to contract HIV or Hep C inside because there's a lack of services and lack of support and treatment and even care, even basic health care once you're inside. A couple more minutes, and I'm just going to go over the Prison Health Now case, which is the case that our partner, the Canadian Aboriginal AIDS Network, is one of the interveners on. And so it was filed on September 25th in 2012 with the Canadian HIV AIDS Legal Network, as well as PASAN, yay, CADI, the Canadian AIDS Information Treatment Exchange, and the Canadian Aboriginal AIDS Network. So they launched a lawsuit against the Government of Canada over its failure to make sterile injection needle, sterile injection equipment available to federal prisoners and prevent the spread of HIV and Hep C in Canada and Canadian federal prisons. With the input of expert witnesses from Canada and beyond, this, along with many of the legal arguments outlined in a report, the goal of this lawsuit is to ensure prisoners' access to a key tool in HIV and Hep C prevention and to establish a legal precedent that will be useful in other jurisdictions seeking to ensure the same. So this is just for federal prisons, so hoping that this will trickle to other other situations. Among the evidence that will be brought forward are affidavits and testimonials from 50 current and former federal prisoners from throughout Canada documenting firsthand accounts of drug use and needle sharing inside. These perspectives provide concrete evidence of the harm prisoners experience when they are denied health services that other citizens can access, right? So just asking and demanding that they not be denied the rights that we all have access to. So remember that all of what I've shared is not new. It's not just Harper. It's not just prisons. This is part of an ongoing colonial project that we're all complicit in and responsible for. Also a reminder that Indigenous youth are not at risk simply because of who we are, but because of systems like this that undermine our authority and self-determination from before even we're born. And while this has been happening, of course, there's always been community-based resistance, whether you're aware of it or not. It's always been happening. Whether you can see and recognize that that's been happening or not, it's been going on. And we will continue to do so and resist and challenge and survive because of, not in spite of, our histories and current realities. And we certainly do not need saving. Anushik, thank you for listening.